It's Tuesday, June 15th. The light was at the end of the tunnel. Then another 100,000 Americans died. We start here. COVID-19's list of victims is hitting a new devastating milestone.
The one thing that the people who are dying have in common almost universally, it's 98-99%, is that they're not vaccinated yet.
Why Americans are continuing to die and why even more could still be lost. You want to counter Russia? You and what army?
Come here to NATO and hear from more allies and also hear from countries that are in Putin's backyard.
What President Biden's NATO meetings tell us about his Putin playbook. And he's the champion of liberals on the Supreme Court, so why are his greatest admirers demanding he step aside?
No one can tell you it's time to go, except they are.
Breyer Watch is picking up steam from everyone who matters, except Justice Breyer. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. The U.S. gave its first emergency use authorizations for COVID-19 vaccines last December. Well, by the end of January, we were administering a million shots a day.
We hope you had a good weekend. Today, our country is going to mark a sobering milestone.
But it was too late for 500,000 Americans.
COVID has killed more Americans than all our wars of the 20th century, World Wars I and II, the Korean War, the Vietnam War combined.
That was in February when the U.S. hit a previously unimaginable death toll, 500,000 killed. Well, then the vaccine numbers increased dramatically.
And every day, with daily cases continuing to fall, we remain encouraged by these positive trends.
The number of COVID cases went way, way down. Deaths slowed, but they haven't stopped.
In Detroit, Holly and Antoine Rivers got COVID as they waited for their chance to get vaccinated in April.
It just got worse and worse.
Antoine, a father of five, was admitted to the hospital, passing away 1 month later in May.
To the point where now, with experts saying all the biggest vaccination drives in this country are likely behind us, the deaths are still happening. And now, that death toll stands right around 600,000.
As we, as a nation, get back to normal, my life will never be normal again. My life stopped being normal.
So I'm going to start the show by checking in with someone who, until last week, was still one of the top members of the Biden administration's coronavirus task force. Andy Slavitt is back out of the government. He's written a book about America's response to the pandemic. He calls it Preventable. Andy, welcome back to the show.
Great to be here, Brad.
Hey, my first question is simply, why are Americans still dying? Like, where are most of these deaths coming from if the vaccination rollout has gone so well?
Well, recall that at our peak, we had about 3,500, 3,600 people dying every single day. And today that number is much, much lower. It's, you know, we had a day this weekend where it was under 100. I think we're averaging about 300 people dying per day. If you look at the charts, almost every age group is down somewhere between 80 to 95%. It's actually the next oldest group. It's actually people that are my age, 55 to 65, where they're a little bit more of an outlier because just enough people haven't been vaccinated. And it's just a little bit more deadly for people that are in my age bracket. But it really shows the effect of vaccinations, the fact that vaccinations work. And the one thing that the people who are dying have in common almost universally, it's 98-99%, is that they're not vaccinated yet.
Hmm.
And if you're not vaccinated yet, you're taking a risk.
Well, I think a lot of us are still wondering, like, can this still somehow get bad? Because even in countries where vaccinations are surpassing our own, I'm thinking of the UK.
But now is the time to ease off the accelerator.
They're actually pushing back their huge nationwide reopening because they're seeing a variant accelerate.
At the end of that period, by July the 19th, we do think that we will have built up a very considerable wall of immunity around the whole of the population.
Like, we used to call this the Indian variant. Authorities are now assigning letters. It's called the Delta variant now. But I mean, how worrisome is this one?
Look, it is something we've always been concerned about and should be concerned about, which is that there are going to be variants that are trickier, that spread more quickly. And those variants are the very reason why communities around the country that don't have high vaccination levels are going to see the potential for more outbreaks.
The new concern tonight about the Delta variant, first seen in India.
What's different about the Delta variant is that it's more infectious. It's much more infectious.
Officials in the UK today delaying reopening plans. The variant now accounting for 90% of all new cases there. Health experts warning it could cause more severe illness.
Think of it as sending out many more particles. So that if you walk into a room with someone who has the Delta variant, if you could see the particles coming out of their mouth, imagine 60 to 70% more. Or imagine them staying in the air 60 to 70% longer after they left the room. That means that in situations where people otherwise might have walked in a room or been exposed to somebody and not gotten COVID-19, now it would take a lot less.
And it's worth really reiterating that these vaccines are really highly effective against the Delta variant.
Well, okay, and then the message, of course, from scientists, from world governments, from the Biden administration has been, get vaccinated. Like that is the answer here. Like that does most of the work here. Well, now another vaccine company, Novavax, has said we had a phase 3 trial. It's done. It looked really good. How would that come into play here? Like, is that primarily overseas? Because I don't know, does it seem a little late in the game for another vaccine in the US?
Well, I think that for one, this is great news for the globe.
The major takeaways from the study are that overall, we had 90% efficacy.
If this gets approved, as we expect it will, we'll be producing hundreds of millions more doses every month. And we need every dose we get our hands on because we've got billions of people on this planet. And we want to get vaccines to all of them as quickly as possible.
We need vaccines that can be used in the U.S. To boost people who have already received a vaccine, and they'll likely need booster vaccines in 6 or 12 months from the original date.
As far as in the U.S., I think we'll have to see. We're a country that likes choice. We like to shop. I don't think we need a different vaccine. We're lucky to have 3 very effective vaccines on the market right now. But, you know, it may be that we learn over time that certain people tolerate the Novavax type of vaccine better, and there'll be potentially a place for it. But right now, I think we should be principally excited about this for the global impact. I think we've moved the virus from being a scary, out of control, anxiety producing unknown to a manageable challenge. So it's not disappeared, but we have many manageable challenges in our lives. We can sort of put this in the category now of something that's here. We should be thoughtful about it. It's not going to disappear, but we no longer have to fear that it's some unknown, anxiety-producing thing that we as a society can't defeat.
It's unreal to walk in the door and they're not here. You keep waiting for them to pop around a corner and they're not.
From this place we were at in January, where things felt very out of control, to where we are today, where we really have the ability to bring back the things in our lives that make us happy.
All right, Andy Slavitt, formerly of the Biden administration, as of a week ago, you got the new book out, Preventable, taking a look at the pandemic response. Andy Slavitt, thank you so much for the time.
Thanks, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, 3 things you got to do when you're in Brussels. Drink the beer, eat the sprouts, and talk to all your allies at NATO. President Biden got at least 1 check mark after the break.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our 2 interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
first foreign trip of the Biden presidency is a lengthy one, more than a week, and it feels like there's this build to the entire thing, an arc, this three-act play.
We do appreciate, and I think we can deliver great things for them.
I think we can do a lot, too.
First, there was the pomp and circumstance, some meetings with our tightest allies in Europe. Well, yesterday, President Biden began Act Two.
So a strong NATO is good for Europe, but it's also good for America.
It's very good for America. Yeah. It's essential for America. Yeah.
Meetings at NATO to talk about serious stuff, security. Meetings continue today with several leaders, some that Biden is close to, others not so much. But you can feel the White House is trying to marshal goodwill across Europe, right? To create the sense of momentum. Because all this leads to Act Three, a one-on-one tomorrow with one of President Biden's most clear-cut adversaries, Vladimir Putin. A lot of new headlines as this trip continues, so let's just take you to Brussels right now. ABC's Karen Travers is part of the caravan that is this diplomatic circus. Karen, a NATO summit is just a chance to say, yay, Europe and U.S., boo, Russia, right? Like, what stuck out to you here?
Yeah, that was part of it, you know, and this was also a chance for the president to go to another world leader summit with what is now a very familiar message, saying that America is back, that the United States is here and stands with European allies.
And I made a point to make clear that the U.S. commitment to Article 5, the NATO treaty, is rock solid and unshakable. It's a sacred commitment.
And here in Brussels, he was really reaffirming the U.S. commitment to the NATO military alliance. And Brad, this is a message that NATO members, from the Secretary General to all the heads of state of the member countries, they are very eager to hear this message from President Biden.
Could you provide some specifics on what a successful meeting would look like to you? Are there going to be specific concessions you want Putin to make?
I think it was striking, Brad, to see how concise, disciplined, and on message the president was in that press conference yesterday. And all of the questions in the beginning of the press conference were focused on that meeting tomorrow with Vladimir Putin.
Look, I've been doing this a long time. The last thing anyone would do is negotiate in front of the world press as to how he's going to approach a critical meeting with another adversary and or someone who could be an adversary.
And the president, he was very measured. He did not want to start negotiating from that podium here in Brussels. He did not want to give any ammunition to Vladimir Putin ahead of their high-stakes showdown.
There are areas where we can cooperate if he chooses. And if he chooses not to cooperate and acts in a way that he has in the past relative to cybersecurity and some other activities, then we will respond.
You know, Brad, I'm a sports fan. You like sports too.
Yes.
Reminded me a little bit of those 2 weeks before the Super Bowl, where there's no games, there's just a lot of press conferences, and the reporters are just getting asked all of the questions of, you know, like, how are you going to beat Tom Brady? How are you going to do this? And, you know, you can tell they start getting frustrated, but they also don't want to share all of that. They want to go and play the game.
Right.
And the president even commented at one point, talking about Vladimir Putin as being bright and tough. And he said, you know, like, when you're playing ball, he's a worthy adversary.
But the fact is that I will be happy to talk with you when it's over, not before.
You got this sense that he's kind of thinking of this like Wednesday's game day, and either going over the playbook, they're watching the tape, they're trying to figure out what Putin might be coming in with, but he's not going to reveal his strategy despite our colleagues' very, very good attempts to get him to do just that.
But has he gotten anything out of the last few days that actually bolster his strategic position? I mean, does it help him to go into Geneva being like, hey, Boris, Emmanuel, Angela, we're tight again. Like, watch out, Russia. Is that part of it? Or are we in the same spot as when Biden left a week ago?
You know, it could be like a little bit of both there. On the one hand, yes, he is very much doing this trip by design, as you put at the beginning of like a three-act play. Go to the G7, hear from some of the most critical U.S. allies about what they think is important for the meeting with Vladimir Putin. Come here to NATO and hear from more allies and also hear from countries that are in Putin's backyard. You know, he met yesterday with the leaders of Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania. They're not like at the top of the agenda for the United States, but those are the countries that are very concerned about Russian aggression.
Belarus will be on the agenda because Vladimir Putin is supportive of the strongman in Belarus, but
So having a meeting like that, it sends a message to Vladimir Putin that, you know, hey, we've got their back, so watch out. And the president yesterday said that, you know, yes, there's been some criticism that he's rewarding Putin by doing this meeting, such an early stage of his own presidency. And the president said, not true.
Every world leader here as a member of NATO that spoke today, and most of them mentioned it, thanked me for meeting with Putin now. Every single one.
He said he heard from those NATO allies what they think is important to raise on Wednesday and what they don't think is important. But unfortunately for us, he did not get into the details of that. He's saving it for Wednesday.
All right, Karen Travers packing it up in Brussels, about to head to Geneva. Thank you so much, Karen.
Thanks, Brad.
June is usually a super busy month for the Supreme Court. This year is no different. Opinions have been flying out of the court multiple times a week. But you're not hearing about a ton of them yet because these are not close votes. You might not know this because we're always talking about the court's controversial decisions, but in a given year, about half the Supreme Court's decisions are unanimous. So far this term, though, that number is close to 70%. These justices are agreeing about almost everything. Of course, the biggest decisions are still likely to come later this month, but if the nine justices are still functioning as one cohesive unit, it also begs the question, how long will this court consist of these members? The only way justices are added or subtracted is through death or retirement. So, who's on the court? Who's doing the job is not usually controversial, except this year. ABC senior Washington correspondent Devin Dwyer joins us. Devin, once you're on the court and you're confirmed, like, that's it, right? No one else gets to vote on you anymore. But it seems like everyone in Washington has an opinion on whether one of these justices should be stepping down.
Yeah, you get to camp out up there. You get to collect your pension. You get to participate in some epic legal cases, Brad. And no one can tell you it's time to go. Except they are right now for 82-year-old Justice Stephen Breyer. He's the oldest member on the bench.
My experience of more than 30 years since the appeals court as a judge has shown me that once men and women take the judicial oath, they take that oath to heart.
He's the most senior member of the court's liberal wing, and he's loving his job. The only problem is you've got all of these progressive Democratic groups right now who were so burned, stunned by the death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg on the watch of Donald Trump. And several years back when President Obama tried to nominate Merrick Garland to replace Antonin Scalia, that they say Breyer has to go now.
Yeah, I believe that we should protect our Supreme Court, and I thought that should absolutely be a consideration.
No more waiting. We need to get a younger liberal justice on the bench while the Democrats have control of the United States Senate. But so far, Brad, Justice Stephen Breyer is giving no indication that he's going anywhere anytime soon.
But wait, I don't get it. Why is it such high stakes then right now? I guess you said that the Democrats control the Senate, but like President Biden, he can appoint someone. It's up to him to appoint someone. He gets another 3.5 years.
Yeah, that's right. And of course, the Democrats have a narrow majority control of the United States Senate for, you know, at least another year plus.
What is the president's view on the calls for Justice Breyer to step down?
He believes that's a decision Justice Breyer will make when he decides it's time to no longer serve on the Supreme Court.
The problem is it is very, very fragile. You know the math. We've talked about the math. But you have a senator like Patrick Leahy from Vermont. He's been in and out of the hospital. Boy, does that suddenly complicate your confirmation process if and when you have a Supreme Court retirement. So all of
like
this
Republicans
pressure,
had rammed things through with 50 votes. You don't even have your 50th vote in any of these scenarios.
That's exactly right. And some huge high stakes cases on the horizon involving abortion. Will they turn over Roe versus Wade? Gun rights. Can you carry a handgun around city streets? Is that a fundamental right? All those things are on the horizon. And add into all that, Brad, Republican leader Mitch McConnell.
The single most consequential thing I've done in my time as majority leader of the Senate, preserve the Scalia vacancy or the Gorsuch appointment.
So McConnell comes out yesterday, Brad, and says that if there's an opening on the Supreme Court in 2024, the year of the presidential election, it is highly unlikely that Republicans would allow any justice, any replacement justice, to be confirmed to the court.
No, I don't think either party, if it controlled, if it were different from the president, would confirm a Supreme Court nominee in the middle of an election.
And then he suggested that maybe in 2023, if the justice isn't to Republicans' liking, he would hold up an appointment, a confirmation at that point, moving the goalposts in the eyes of some liberals. So they are outraged.
Wait, that's a year earlier than last time.
That's right. And McConnell defends all this, saying, you know, the Senate has the power to advise and consent on nominations. It's within their full right.
We'd have to wait to see what happens.
But this interview with Mitch McConnell and Hugh Hewitt, radio show, it really sends another signal to Democrats, progressives outside the court in these advocacy groups that Stephen Breyer really needs to get going. But again, he's got a book coming out. He's hired a full slate of clerks for next term.
This is not the first time that people have become discouraged with the democratic process.
Just a couple of weeks ago, he gave a speech to a number of high school students, and he was talking about his staying power. He said one of the lessons that he's learned in doing this job in all these years is don't let up.
Don't let up. And there you are. And as you get older, you think that's a very big virtue, a very big virtue.
Wow. Talk about a tea leaf of someone who doesn't really sound like they're ready to give up.
I was going to say, I wasn't laughing at him staying in office, but if these justices know the power of their words. So if he's talking about staying power, he knows exactly what he's putting out there. In the meantime, just huge decisions coming up on Obamacare, on voting rights, on whether a cheerleader can say bad things about her school on Snapchat, freedom of speech issues, just a fascinating set of decisions ahead. Devin Dwyer will be with you for all that, but you'll get him even sooner than that because he's hosting tomorrow morning. He's filling in for me. Thank you in advance, Devin.
Thanks, Brad. Have a good one.
We're going to take one more quick break, but when we come back, you got the power. Unless you're in Texas, one last thing is next.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
And one last thing, if you encounter bad service at a restaurant, well, guess what, servers? Tips are not going to be that great. If your banking service goes down, well, people are probably going to find a new bank. But if your power company is having a bad year, well, you might be the one who's got to change your habits.
This morning, Arctic air, power grids failing, and millions left to cope with the bitter cold.
Remember ERCOT, the Texas Power Council that controls the state's energy grid?
This was a total failure by ERCOT.
When winter storms swept through Texas this year, entire sections of the grid went down. Some were off for days. People lost heat, lost access to clean tap water.
ERCOT stands for Electric Reliability Council of Texas. And they showed that they were not reliable.
And the reason given by officials was, listen, it was so cold outside, we could not have predicted this. So everyone just needs to conserve electricity for a while longer to keep us from overloading the system. Okay, this week, Texas is hot. And once again, ERCOT is telling customers, we need you to conserve.
They were sort of as surprised as the rest of us to find out that electricity, enough to power about 2.4 million homes, was taken offline today.
Officials say a lot of power plants have been knocked offline recently, mostly natural gas plants. And plus, we didn't really think it would get this hot this quickly, they say. We didn't know everyone would need all the air conditioners right now. To which residents are saying, wait, this was totally predictable. I'm sorry, hot weather in Texas in June? What is going on here?
Now, the good news here, they say they do not anticipate that we're going to have any rolling outages, but they are worried about some potential scarcities in power.
A good chunk of the ERCOT leadership either resigned or was fired since February, but a current spokesperson still couldn't say what caused these outages in the first place.
We operate the grid with the resources that we have available.
Regardless of the cause, though, residents are being asked to not run their dishwashers or washing machines through perhaps Friday, and to keep the thermostats turned up to 78 degrees. just what I want to be doing in Dallas in June, sleeping in an 80-degree room at night. Hey, if you got power and a functioning phone, follow us on Twitter, on Instagram, Facebook, at Start Here ABC. I'm Brad Milkey. I'm off tomorrow, but I'll be back later in the week. See you then.